We begin with this month's chapter of our series on the century-old 19th Amendment that cleared the way for women to vote. Some women, that is. Here's series co-host Kathy Kern.
My guest today is Dr. Anastasia Curwood, Associate Professor of History at the University of Kentucky and also the Director of African American and Africana Studies. Thank you, Dr. Curwood, so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So you are completing a biography of Shirley Chisholm called Chisholm, The Life of an American Symbol.
That's correct.
And I'm eager to ask you about that and to hear what you think Chisholm would be thinking about our celebration of the 19th Amendment. But let me start by asking you, when we think about the history of the 19th Amendment or the history of voting rights and African-American women, the story doesn't really end in 1920. It's really just getting started, isn't it?
That's correct. And the reason was is that Black women have a couple of categories of identity. They're women and they are also Black. And 1920 was the height of Jim Crow America when all sorts of legal and extra-legal obstacles were there for Black voters. So part of their identity had been just added as a constitutionally protected category for voting, but part had not.
If we were going to help our students, for example, think about a longer timeline that really gets at the history of Black women's voting rights, what would you point out? What are the important milestones?
Well, if you remember one thing about Black women's voting rights and Black people's voting rights, it's that 1965 Voting Rights Act that Lyndon B. Johnson signed. And up until that point, there really was very little enforcement of the constitutional protection of Black men for to have suffrage. And in practice, Black people, both Black men and women, had been given the runaround. There were all sorts of workarounds that white supremacists had used to keep Black people from voting. So the 1965 Voting Rights Act sought to change all those things. And what's really interesting or important about it is that it looked at not just access to voting, but also outcomes. So if there was an outcome of unequal representation at the ballot box, that was subject to federal oversight and enforcement.
For folks who are listening, it can seem confusing that we would have the 15th Amendment that prohibited states from eliminating the right to vote based on conditions of previous servitude, color, et cetera. And we have the 19th Amendment, but we still needed that Voting Rights Act of 1965. So help us to understand why the civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, is so necessary to really create the conditions of democracy for our voters.
To go back to that 1965 Voting Rights Act is actually to go back to the 1860s and 70s, when there was a movement in the 1860s to protect the ability of Black Americans to vote. However, in the 1870s, there was a lot of violence in trying to reduce the political power of Black Americans, and that violence lasted through the almost 100 years until the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So even though slavery had been, for the most part, abolished, there was still the idea that Black Americans were less than white Americans and needed to be prevented from voting. And that was used to justify all sorts of horrific violence that was perpetrated on Black people in the United States. So this was the tip of the iceberg in terms of the states passing all sorts of laws that on paper did not look like racially discriminatory laws, but were in fact racially discriminatory, such as tests for voter registration, often called literacy tests, but they were really very difficult politics and government exams, poll taxes, and laws about your ancestors being able to vote dictating whether you could vote yourself. So all of those remain in place. We would call it voter suppression today, but at that point, historians call that disenfranchisement through an array, a patchwork of legal means. And they were still there, along with the violence, as of 1965.
It's really sometimes hard to imagine when we're working with young people and there's voter apathy and they communicate their views eloquently on social media, but they don't always get out to vote. And so it's hard to convey to people how Americans risk their lives to try to register to vote, and how important this legislation in 1965 was to say there's going to be some kind of federal oversight to make sure that these citizens actually get to exercise this right of democracy.
That's absolutely right. We had at best a flawed democracy if we had a democracy prior to 1965 and that act, because a whole swath 10 to 14% of Americans could not exercise the right of suffrage. And voting was construed as a privilege and not a right. And what tells you just how important that was is how much effort white supremacists invested in keeping people from voting. It was a major project because white supremacists, at least, recognized that political power was a threat to racism and the exercise of racism. Not only that, but Black Americans recognized that political power was the key to them for changing the lived everyday conditions that they had to deal with as Black people. Everything from whether or not their trash got picked up, which you can imagine not having trash picked up is actually a big deal, to whether or not they could hold office and serve on juries. And it's important to remember that this was not necessarily clear-cut or obvious to people. In 1964, it was still contentious among many white Americans whether Black people really should vote. This was not a foregone conclusion at all. It was the way things were, and people justified it by saying, well, this is how it should be. Not all Black voters, in fact, many Black voters are not educated. Many Black voters would not vote correctly. They're uninformed and not really fit for citizenship. And that was just how things were. It actually took a movement, not just the inspiration one day of the federal government, to bring that change about.
I want to fast forward a little bit past 1965 to the work that you're doing on Shirley Chisholm. How does her life and her work give us some insight into what comes next for Black Americans after the Voting Rights Act of 1965?
Shirley Chisholm is really interesting because she is elected in that immediate aftermath of the Voting Rights Act of 65. She was elected to the United States Congress as the first Black Congresswoman. And she got in kind of the biggest class yet of congressmen and women. So she was a direct beneficiary of the Voting Rights Act and resulting lawsuits about one person, one vote in terms of congressional districts. So there was a district that got created in Divescent, New York, in the borough of Brooklyn. But not only that, she took the idea of voting as sort of a necessary but not sufficient part of getting Black political power. And she was doing so in this, what we call the Black Power era, when Black people activists put the words Black and power together to talk about the actual control over their own destinies that Black people should have. So Chisholm took that to the next step. And she said, well, Black people should have representation in Congress, not just because Black people should see another Black person there, see someone who looks like them, but because someone who has lived those experiences would understand how important reform and change would be. And she immediately started to advocate for things that would help Black people Her first speech on the floor of the House of Representatives was actually an anti-war speech. And it wasn't because of the wrongness of the military objectives. It was because all the resources going to the Vietnam War should have been used to feed, clothe, and house Americans, she said. So she immediately started to look at those bread and butter issues that Black people needed and saw a direct connection to politics. So she spent most of her career expanding political representation, including in a historic run for president in 1972.
Well, that's really an interesting insight because it deepens our idea about political representation. We often think about representation in a kind of superficial way, as you were saying, someone who looks like us in a position of power. But you're saying it's the lived experience, and it sounds to me like the class dimension of what she was bringing to the critique about race in America.
Oh, absolutely. Her understanding of what should happen in politics was informed by a word we use a lot now, intersectionality, which is looking at the intersections of oppression. How do people have power and how do they not have power? And just because someone might acquire power in one area, say Black people get access to elected office, doesn't mean that poor Black people have their interests looked out for, that women have their interests looked out for, et cetera, et cetera. I would say her advocacy on behalf of people who were on welfare and her advocacy for minimum wage protections for people working in domestic service, those were intersectional because you would look at, well, what do the poorest people need who are on the downside of power in terms of race, the downside of power in terms of their gender? What do those people need? Because if you protect those people, if you respond to their needs, actually, it winds up helping everybody.
It's an important lens during the COVID-19 pandemic as well, right?
Yeah.
Shirley Chisholm's vision of what political power really means and what political participation really means resonates with our contemporary moment.
Yeah, power is not an abstract who's up and who's down for her. Power means who is healthy, who has a good education, who is actually able to make a living rather than working three jobs. Power is in, for her, it's in a legislative practice and in an electoral practice. And for her, she was a Black woman, so it's in her body itself. She could see in these multiple vantage points, but she enacted it in her work every day. Sometimes people call these issues, these bread and butter issues, human rights issues, and I think that might make it sound abstract and international, but she saw the need for human rights right here in America. And she was trying to dismantle structures of power so that people could just get whatever it was that they needed to live lives that are secure and livable.
What your work on Shirley Chisholm reminds us is that the right to vote, voting rights, is also not just an abstraction in American history. It's rooted in the local and in bread and butter and in trying to intervene in our contemporary problems.
Yes, that's absolutely true. For her, voting was not an abstraction. It was, what kind of shape do you want your community to have? What do you need within your community? She actually won her seat against someone who was from outside the community, someone from Manhattan who was nationally famous. His name was James Farmer, and he had been the leader of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality. That was her opponent in the general election. He actually ran as a Republican. This was back when there were liberal Republicans. He ran as a Republican against her in 1968, and she won. Because, well, the Republican Party was a stronghold in her area, but he was pretty close. So what she had to do was talk about how she understood that community. And what she did was she lobbied women. She ran her campaign approaching women, talking to women, seeing what women told her that they needed, and assuring them that she would be looking out for their interests. And this actually cut across racial lines, and she won.
Dr. Kerwood, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today about the 19th Amendment and about Black women's voting rights. My guest has been Dr. Anastasia Kerwood. Thank you so much for your time and your work.
My pleasure. It's good talking to you.